Hello, faithful listeners. This is your friends at Laser Guided Melodies, and this is episode 13.
I'm Lauren James, and this is Ed Biggs.
Evening.
And over the next half an hour or so, we'll be bringing you reviews of the biggest and best new releases from the week, starting the 16th and the 23rd of June. We've got clips and analysis of the new albums by Lana Del Rey, Ed Sheeran, The Antlers and Klaxons. We'll also be looking back at a couple of classic albums, including The Prodigy's second album, Music for the Jilted Generation, which was released 20 years ago on the 4th of July, and Razorlight's debut album, Up All Night, which was released 10 years ago on the 28th of June. And we've also got a reissue this week for the 30th anniversary of the legendary Enemy compilation, C86. You can also visit our website for more album reviews from the last 2 weeks, which includes Deadmau5, Tom Veck, Cerebral Ballsy, Example, Alex G and Linkin Park. You can find all those by typing laserguidedmelodies.co.uk into the address bar of your browser. Now, on with the news. Dun 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 dun.
Yeah, we need a proper jingle for our news bit.
You may have heard recently that the British singles chart will be undergoing something of a revolution in the coming weeks.
Yeah, for the first time ever, streaming is going to count towards chart sales figures. This is particularly revolutionary because the UK singles chart has only ever been sales-based in the past, and that's unique throughout the world. In the United States, the Billboard charts count radio plays and jukebox plays too, which is kind of arcane and old-fashioned, but kind of dates all the way back to the 40s and 50s.
It is worth noting that YouTube will not be included in the new charts.
No, but there'll
just be streaming sites such as Spotify.
Yeah, Spotify, Deezer, and there's a number of others as well. 100 streams is going to count as one sale. If you play a song for 30 seconds or more, it will be counted as a stream. But to prevent cheating and basically to prevent One Direction fans from like going out and leaving something on repeat all day, only a maximum of 10 streams per user per day for one song is going to be allowed.
Wow. So there's a lot of new rules coming at the same time.
Yeah. But I can't see how this is going to affect the charts too much from where it is at the moment, because at the moment it's currently song-based rather than singles-based. And it's certainly going to be different from the 90s when I started listening to the charts. You'd have a song that would be on the radio for like up to a month beforehand, and then it would enter at number one and then just fall down the charts the next week. Songs just wouldn't behave as they did in the 60s, where they'd hang around for months if they were good. Basically, it's not as prone to sort of record labels marketeering the entire thing.
Yeah.
And just, yeah, it's less open to exploiting than you might imagine at first glance. Anyway, another bit of news. Aphex Twin has released, in inverted commas, a new album.
We say released, we mean a bunch of fans have created a kind of Kickstarter campaign to raise £40,000 to buy...
That's an unbelievable amount of money.
To buy the album from an eBay user, and then instead of hoarding it amongst themselves, they very kindly put it on YouTube.
Yeah, basically, this album dates back to 1994, which is Aphex Twin's sort of imperial phase. I mean, he's always been one of the most interesting artists that this country's ever produced. But for some reason, he scrapped this album called Caustic Window and released Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, an album which we did a piece about a few months ago, I think. It's absolutely fantastic, but completely different to Selected Ambient Works. But the reason it costs so much money is because there's only 5 copies in existence. It only ever made it to the test pressing stage before Aphex ditched the release. So, yeah, incredibly rare. And with Aphex Twin's permission, it's up on YouTube.
There's only one question I have to ask. Was it worth it?
It's more than worth it. It's an exceptional record. But it doesn't really tell us much that we didn't know already. We knew that Richard D. James was genius. And that remains the case. It's a fascinating artifact, and there's always been rumours that he's got tons and tons of unreleased material that he just keeps on his laptop to play to his friends when he rolls home drunk from the pub. So if there's more and more archives of this stuff, then hopefully we can see and hear more of it without having to shell out £40,000. Hopefully, come on, Richard, make some more music, please.
Well, I'm with the albums now. Currently sitting at number one on the UK albums chart is the second Lana Del Rey record, Ultraviolence. She catapulted onto the scene with the single Video Games and a big album called Born to Die during 2011 and 2012. And she's now released her follow-up to the album, which
is her first to have hit the Billboard 200 number one in America. While she mull over that, here's a clip of Brooklyn Baby. We'll see what Ed has to say about it.
Well, my boyfriend's in a band. He plays guitar while I sing Larry. I've got feathers.
Brooklyn Baby there from Lana Del Rey's latest number one selling album, Ultraviolence.
So then, Lana Del Rey, the stage name of American singer Lizzie Grant, broke through at the back end of 2011 with Video Games. Born to Die came out about a year later in 2012, which was a bit of a hodgepodge in my opinion. It was kind of like somebody trying on different clothes and seeing what would fit and not, and then just discarding it and moving on to something else. It made for an interesting but quite an inconsistent debut album. I mean, what did you think of her debut?
I thought it was like a magazine of ideas. Each page was a different photo shoot. Yeah, you're right. Lana trying on a new outfit, a new scene, more scene setting. She was a different person in society in each one.
Yeah. She was kind of aiming for a bit of a Madonna thing going on, you know, sort of the costume changes within the album, basically. But this time, she's picked an outfit and she's stuck with it. It's the Lana Del Rey of Summertime Sadness and Video Games. It's full of the typical romantic fatalism, and the Hollywood film noir, a vulnerable female character that plays upon male fantasies.
Being romanced by older men.
Yeah, basically the whole point is that the listener has to buy into the concept. Only you can save her from her misery. That's the kind of thing that she's playing on. But you only need to look at the front cover of this new album to see it. It's just Lana Del Rey in black and white looking at you down the camera, sort of sultrily. For this album, she brought in Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys to produce it, and he's somebody who seems to have got an instinct for what Lana wants to achieve on this album.
He really does. I heard that she'd recorded all the songs, then brought him in to re-record them. That's how much faith she placed in him.
Yeah, I can believe that. That's a pretty good way of actually recording material, isn't it? It's getting the producer in last.
They went and bought a lot of cheap toy shop microphones, basically, and recorded them all again to give it that distinctive sound.
It sounds quite old-fashioned, doesn't it? I mean, it's quite sort of crackly in some places, just like kind of authentic vinyl sound.
The vintage sound, isn't it?
Yeah. The opener called Cruel World has got his fingerprints all over it, the kind of bluesy guitar that you can hear on the new Black Keys album, which is called Turn Blue. And it's made for a very consistent and coherent record. I mean, the pace is uniformly quite slow, and it's probably unlikely to win over people who weren't into her the first time round, because Del Rey is all about image. It's so dependent on that image and sort of the image associations that go along with it, of violence, of self-loathing, drugs, emotional turmoil, but all delivered in that Ice Queen style that she seems to play that card again and again. But like I say, while it is slow paced and the delivery itself is quite slow, breathy, half asleep and kind of quite hard to make out at times, it does require work from the listener. But there is now a clearer connection between image and content, and it finally delivers some actual artistic credibility to the whole Lana Del Rey project. And it's about time, I'd say.
I'd say standout track would be the lead single from the album, West Coast.
Mm. It's been four singles already.
Yeah, encapsulates the themes of older lovers. You know, she's thinking about her toy boy and a older rich guy at the same time, and old Hollywood themes. It's just Lana Del Rey all over. You know, that sultry kind of drawl.
Yeah, but now we have like a kind of a clearer image of who she is. Anyway, we awarded it 7 out of 10.
That's fair, I'd say.
Yeah. What have we got next, Lauren?
Chart sensation Ed Sheeran released the hotly anticipated follow-up to his debut album Plus, the imaginatively titled Multiply, on Monday this week, almost certainly heading for number one to dethrone Del Rey. This is a clip of Photograph.
Meet, you won't ever be alone. Wait for me to come home. Loving can heal. Loving can mend your soul.
was Photograph from Ed Sheeran's new album Multiply. I'm looking over at Ed and I can see a vein pulsing, a bead of sweat forming, something's going on in his eye. I think it's some kind of blood vessel burst.
You don't
want to
make me angry kind of thing.
I feel a rant coming on, listeners.
Well, although we pride ourselves on this show about being objective and wherever possible kind, I have despised Ed Sheeran ever since I first heard the A-Team. It was hate at first sight, basically. So you'd expect Knives Out for the second album then. And it's actually okay. I mean, I'm quite disappointed to say it. I mean, I think what your reaction to this album is going to be is going to be determined by how you react to Plus, his first album. If you liked it, I think you might see Multiply as a bit of a dilution. If you didn't, like me, you'll probably see it as a flawed but admirable attempt to kind of stretch out for a different audience. It's got problems. It's not very coherent. It's too long. And the track's still irritating in places. But Sing, which you've probably heard, it was recently number one in this country, and it's probably going to be number one in America any week soon, is produced by Pharrell Williams. And it's a very clear attempt to go for the American market. Runaway does exactly the same trick. He's brought in a few big-name producers as well. Jeff Basker, who's a long-standing R&B producer, and Rick Rubin, who's done lots of...
He's done lots.
Yes, he did the last Jake Bugg album, I think. They also appear to try and give some of these tracks a broader appeal. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Jake Gosling, the producer and co-writer of Plus, is on this album to try and give a bit of consistency, like a bit of a bridge between people who are fans of Plus and how the new Sheeran is going to sound like. And unsurprisingly, they're the ones that sound most like Plus. And that's where it falls down, because Plus was music for adverts, basically. All the rhyming schemes were intensely irritating stuff. There's one on the new song called Don't, which says it rhymes before text message was the only way to reach you with takeaway pizza. You probably heard me thump the desk there, and it just makes me want to throttle
That's
the nearest person.
Good. Didn't realise that.
Oh, it's terrible, Lauren.
You have to ask, though.
He's a ham.
He has said himself that he doesn't care about his personal appearance. He doesn't care about
absolutely
how he looks to fans.
He's a very successful young man, and he shouldn't care.
Why
either.
Is he so? If you're ranting about him like this and saying he's mediocre, half cooked, then
I never said he was mediocre. I just said he was irritating. Some people might love him.
Implied his music was mediocre. So why is he so famous? Because One Direction bands like that. It's obvious that 60% of their charm to their audience, that is arguably the same as Ed Sheeran's audience, is because they're quite,
best mates, aren't they?
Cute and dashing. I'm not saying that Ed Sheeran's not cute. He has said himself, though, that he doesn't see his appearance as part of his music at all. I mean, is that up for debate? I'm not sure.
Well, fair enough. I think it's immaterial. I found Plus an intensely irritating experience. But at least it was coherent and consistent. But that's the problem with Multiply. It isn't. And like I said, if you liked Plus, you might see this as like kind of a betrayal of his roots. But there's been some pretty good reviews for this so far. But I think people have been slightly too kind to me. I mean, it drifts. There's a song called The Man, which is actually a really good song. It's an analysis of his rise to fame and how it affected the relationships of people he was friends with before he got famous. If it ended there, it would be fine. But it goes on for two more tracks. There's another song called I'm a Mess, which is kind of a more improved version of the kind of drunken confessional that he does on Plus. I mean, Ed Sheeran's never been about taking drugs. I mean, his vice is clearly drinking, isn't it? It's such a recurrent theme in all of his songs. But like I said, it's a bit of a shapeshifter, this one. It doesn't quite know what it wants to be. He's clearly making a move for the American market, but also wants to stay on sort of on terra firma at the same time. And it makes up for a slightly long and quite inconsistent, but at times, actually, and I must admit, quite enjoyable album.
He has a very clever way of... Perhaps it's been enhanced since he's been hanging around with his tour buddy and best friend, Taylor Swift, but he has a very clever way of...
And best friend.
Yeah, of talking about emotion in a way that a lot of people can't, and it conveys it really well. Maybe that's that's what people connect to in his music.
Yeah, maybe it's just...
He's a good songwriter. He's hated by many because of his audience. You think Screaming Girls, you think it's not...
No, I think Irritating Drunken Students, actually. I mean, maybe it's just an age thing. Maybe if I'd been 21 when Plus came out rather than, 26, then...
I disagree. I think you're looking at pre-teens here.
Anyway, we can't disagree. I award it 4, 3 to 3. If you like it, fair enough. It's a different beast to the first one, and that's to be applauded because you quite easily have stood on the same ground and just been irritating all over again.
Moving on, who out there remembers the shortly-lived new rave phenomenon of the late noughties? Well, it was personified by the London band's Klaxons.
Klaxons.
Who won the 2007 Mercury Music Prize for their first album, Myths of the Near Future. They're back with their third album, which is called Love Frequency, sitting at number 38 in the charts. Here's a clip of the opening track, A New Reality. Reality by the Klaxons from their latest album, Love Frequency.
Why are we saying Klaxons, incidentally?
What do you say?
Klaxons.
That's what I said.
You said Klaxons, like it's French.
Whatever.
It's good. Anyway.
Carry on.
Anyway, yes, I can remember the shortly lived new rave phenomenon, but I suspect it only existed in the heads of NME editors. outside of Klaxons, there were perhaps 2 or 3 other bands who could. Conceivably have been shoehorned into that phenomenon. But basically, Klaxons then won the Mercury Music Prize for their debut, spent nearly 4 years on a follow-up, including they scrapped the album at least once, and at last they returned in 2010 with Surfing the Void to what was a more universal shrug of shoulders. The world had moved on without them. New Rave, to the extent that it had ever existed, had gone a very long time ago. So now they're back after another nearly 4 year gap. With what is with a last desperate lunge for relevance with Love Frequency. They've pulled in a few big name producers here. Tom Rowlands from Chemical Brothers, James Murphy from LCD Sound System and the DFA record label, Errol Alkan, who was kind of the dance music producer du jour of the mid-noughties. But frankly, you can barely detect their presence on Love Frequency. The titles of the tracks give it away. Children of the Sun, Rhythm of Life, Liquid Light. I mean, they're just kind of... They sound like they're not trying very hard. They could be just any
sounds
tracks.
Like a parody.
Yeah, like a parody of like the original, the old school rave scene, basically. And the music reflects this. It's very flabby and stale and full of unimaginative rhythms that just kind of sound like the Chemical Brothers on really lazy autopilot. And it suggests they think, okay, well, we've kind of forgotten what it is that we're supposed to be doing here. I mean... This is what people expect from a Klaxons record, right? I mean, you just heard A New Reality, and it sounds like Ross from Friends on keyboard, doesn't it? When he's got that microphone, he's going, "This reality." It's just, it's terrible. I mean, it sounds like another band trying to be Klaxons. But quite aside from that really naff song, I mean, that is the worst offender. It does get a little bit better from there on. But it's nowhere near as silly as it needs to be to make the material work. Part of the joy with Myths of the Near Future was kind of the homemade nature of it all. Those madcap references to literature and time travel and the occult that were all kind of thrown together in a blender. A perfect example of what I like to call an adventure playground record, where all the tracks sound pretty different to each other, but they're all held together by a common theme. But you can't really replicate that same formula twice, and it turns out Klaxons were unable to last time, and they haven't been able to with their third album. I don't know if you remember, we played There Is No Other Time a few months ago, and that is a decent track, but it's the only decent track on here. And Lauren, you pointed out when I'm listening to it, it uses that exact kind of backing vocal that Golden Scans was always so successful. It was like, So, basically, what Klaxons have done here is to make an entirely anonymous electro dance album that could have been made by anybody in the last 10 years and doesn't sound like Klaxons. 3 out of 10.
I have nothing to add to that.
Yeah. And you shouldn't. It's a poor effort, and I think Claxton to be done now.
So, next, we might as well move on.
Yeah.
New York three-piece. The Antlers released their fifth album, Familiars, last week. They deal in a brand of dream pop, folk and post-rock that had the critics purring upon its release, though it only entered the charts in this country at a modest number 94. We'll see what Ed has to say about it after this clip of the first single, Palace. He left the tallest peak of your paradise, buried in the bottom of a canyon at hell. But I swear I'll find your light in the middle, where there's so little that at night, down in the pit of the well. Then when heaven has a light around the corner, we shouldn't have Palace. From the Antlers' fifth album, Familiars, which was released last week.
Well, we decided to end this episode on a bit of a high note because, you know, I didn't like Ed Sheeran, I didn't like Claxton, so best leave you with something positive. Like I say, they've been relatively unknown in this country until their last album, Hospice. Matty Langham reviewed this and he loved it, gave it 8 out of 10, and I agree with him. I mean, it's not the most immediate record. You probably got a sense of, you know, something unravelling quite slowly. You have to let this album grow on you, and you have to make an emotional investment. I mean, but the rewards are bounteous if you choose to put some time and effort into it. His voice, Pete Silverman's voice, is very reminiscent of Jonesy from Sigur Rós, wasn't it?
I will
submit to you on all matters whale music related. It kind of sounds like Jeff Buckley as well, doesn't it? You're kind of unsure whether it is a male or a female voicing. Music's very sparse, but at the same time quite intricate. There's very good use of trumpets and brass that differentiate the Antlers from quite a lot of other post-rock and dream pop bands like Beach House and Lower Dens.
To me, sounds like a cop-out, but it sounds like exactly the kind of music that you'd expect a band called The Antlers to be making.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, you listen to it and it brings up visions of earthy woodlands.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, we're not talking
streams and stuff.
We're not talking Midlake or Fleet Foxes here, are we? We're talking something a bit more sort of futuristic, yeah, in a way.
I wouldn't say futuristic. It's too...
Okay, timeless then.
Perhaps. It's not the kind of album that on a first listen you'd think, wow, I really like that song, I'll go back to that. It's,
yeah, same here. I had to give it two or three listens.
It's the kind of album that you embrace as a whole rather than just one song, I think. The kind of album that you'd put on during a meal with a loved one because it would soundtrack it nicely. But, you know, someone might say, oh, that's nice music, but, you know, it wouldn't exactly intrude the situation.
It's a headphones album.
It's a good
album.
Thing. I'm framing it as a bad thing.
But, well, dinner party music.
Yeah, but it is. It's beautiful, but not arresting.
It's a headphones album, I think. When I encounter albums like this that don't grab you immediately, it's often because you actually need the source of music, like, directly in your ears. I mean, that helps immerse you in the atmosphere a lot better, I think. And I think Antlers is one of them. It's a grower. I mean, I know that is definitely a cop-out to say it's a grower. Yes. I mean, people were saying about that about Kid A for ages, weren't they? No, I loved it, but it took a bit of time.
Anniversary's time now. First up, The Prodigy's second album, Music for the Jilted Generation, which is about to turn 20. We've got clips of Break and Enter, No Good, Start the Dance, in brackets, and Their Law. You just heard three clips from Prodigy's second album, Music for the Jilted Generation, which is about to turn 20. Can you believe it, Ed?
Well, I can't exactly remember it from the first time around, but yeah, it's a big landmark for such a weird little album.
Landmark for dance music.
Yeah. British dance albums from 1994 need to be placed in the context of the politics of the time. Michael Howard and the Conservative government had just put in place the Criminal Justice Act 1994 in order to clamp down on all forms of alternative culture, squatting, gypsies, football fan culture, and in particular raves, held on private property, and which had riot vans turning up in their droves. It was something that really kind of frightened the establishment quite a lot. The provisions of this act were very badly drafted. I'm doing a bit of a legal background here. They were badly drafted in an atmosphere of very clear moral panic, and there's actually a stipulation in the act which specifically forbids, I think it's called repetitive beats or something like that. I mean, define repetitive beats, for goodness sake. Anyway, the music author John Savage goes into this a lot more deeply than I intend to do so here. You can find a lot of material of his on the internet. In a counter-response, you get a clutch of records in 1994 that have got either subtle or overt political messages infused in them. Orbital made an album called Snivelization, that came out then. The B-side of one of its singles was called Criminal Justice Bill? And that just consisted of 4 minutes of silence, as if to say, I mean, if there's a criminal justice bill, then there's going to be no more music anymore. Underworld's Dub No Bass with My Headman was out that year too, and that was paced in such a way as kind of to make dance music evolve into a more of a rock experience. And you've also got the Prodigy's Music for the Jilted Generation. The fold-out artwork contained a landscape painting of young people at a rave raising their middle fingers across a canyon into a darkened, polluted cityscape full of police waiting for them on the other side. And on it was the message, how can the government stop young people having a good time? Fight this bollocks. And at the time, a lot of people saw this as a bit naff, but it's now become pretty iconic because the Prodigy have lasted for so long and are still so popular. Because in many ways, the Criminal Justice Bill was the best thing to happen to them, because it allowed the Prodigy to reinvent themselves from these kind of happy-clappy day glows or original ravers from 1992, where it's all about the whistles and neon colours and all that, into a kind of establishment-scaring, parent-scaring sort of bunch of refuseniks who could appeal to listeners outside of that simple rave context. It helped them evolve. Basically, the Prodigy from this point on start to become a fundamentally more rock experience, to the point where they're now, I think they're now headline Download, don't they?
They have done.
Yeah, pretty much inconceivable if you listen to Experience and think, is this the same band? Basically, many of their 1992 contemporaries died out as a result and became irrelevant, but the Prodigy evolved. The music itself on this album is quite harder and sort of more edgy than Experience, their debut. It has the attitude of the fat of the land, but it's largely still wedded to that kind of American house and rave sound. But in places, it moves into drum and bass, which is a uniquely British invention. The singles from it are Voodoo People, One Love, No Good, which you heard, and Poison, all reach the top 20, two of which reach the top 10. Kicks off with Break and Enter, which you heard. It's blisteringly fast-paced and edgy and dark and threatening, and the pace barely lets up throughout.
It's the kind of music that your gran or your mum would go, turn off that racket.
Yeah, and that appealed to the kind of audience that it was after. But the key track is the one afterwards called Their Law, which is a real go authority. I mean, it goes, F them and their law quite a lot throughout.
So,
I mean, it's got, it sounds kind of dated now, but it's still a fan favourite. There's also a three-track coda to it, which makes it structurally quite interesting, called The Narcotic Suite, which were three instrumentals, which are a very different feel to the rest of the album. I mean, I would say it was designed for the chill-out room, but it's far too dark and twisted for that. And it was a gamble that paid off very successfully. It sold 600,000 copies in the UK to date. It reached number one for 1 week on its release. And, like I said, it caused them to outlive the scene that initially spawned them. And the follow-up, The Fat of the Land, it made them briefly the biggest band in the world. It entered at number one in 23 countries. I think that's a record still. So, Yeah, Music for the Jilted Generation is a bridge album between two versions of the Prodigy, both of which are very fondly remembered. It's essential owning. It's a wonderful record. So one more album.
Yeah, briefly now, Razor Light's Up All Night turns 10 years old on June the 28th. It's the album that broke them big in both this country and around the world. To start off, here's a little clip of Don't Go Back to Dalston.
But don't go back to Dalston. Don't go up the junction.
Back to Dalston there by Razor Light from their debut Up All Night, which is now 10 years old. Can you believe that? Now we're talking about albums that I was aware of when they came out.
In terms of musical consciousness, this is a lot more sort of germane, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Really listening to those tracks again today, so evocative of a certain era. It's unbelievable. You're right back there in 2004 when you listen to the songs. I suppose that means it hasn't aged particularly well.
It hasn't actually, in all fairness. I mean, it reached number three upon its release, which was very impressive for a debut album. Five singles were released from it: Rock and Roll Lies, Rip It Up, Stumble and Fall, Golden Touch and Vice. And there was also a sixth on the reissue of the album called Somewhere Else, which actually sampled Applause from one of their own gigs. I mean, the big-headedness of Johnny Burrell is clearly in there. But it was just that was all just about justified at this point in time. Though it hasn't aged well, it is an interesting document of 2004 when post-Libertines British guitar music was really booming and producing all sorts of
jangly stuff.
Yeah, bands that are no longer around now but still distinctive. That's kind of what happened to Razorlight. I mean, their fall from grace was really quite alarming.
They're still around. They're the band that refused to give up their fame. I saw a picture of Johnny Burrell today with a huge beard. They're releasing a new album.
Zeitgeist.
They're still going.
I know. Basically, what happened is Andy Burrows, the drummer, basically wrote all of those songs that made them famous. He left the band after the second album, and therefore you get Slitway Fires, which is generally regarded as probably the most disastrous follow-up album in the history of British music. Wire to Wire.
I didn't think it was that bad.
It was...
Wire to Wire. I enjoy that song. It was the stuff that came after that was bad. I'm not saying I'm a massive Razorlight fan, but that song, I enjoyed it. I just like to point it out.
Okay. But he was writing out songs like 60 Thompson and sort of about having his hot-bodied girlfriend and a motorbike and all that. Just terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Anyway, but this album itself does borrow very heavily from Patti Smith and Horses, the album in particular. Which Way Is Out and Vice and In the City, they all steal from Patti Smith, either rhythmically or just outright musically. The seeds of Razorlight's downfall are already detectable in Up All Night, but it's an album that whatever chemistry was there, it worked, and it allowed them to play Live 8 the year later. You can barely imagine a new guitar act being able to soar to that kind of fame on the back of just one album.
It's just what happened then.
I know.
It wasn't even that long ago, but the whole musical landscape was different.
I know. Anyway, it's got one more little thing. What is it?
I think we've got a few words on the reissue of the C86 compilation by NME.
Yeah, well, basically, in the 80s, the NME, i.e. the New Musical Express, the sort of much maligned music newspaper, they used to do sort of send-away offers for sort of compilation tapes featuring bands they used to talk about. You know, you'd sort of send in sort of, I don't know, however much money it was, and then you get this tape, like, once every sort of, twice a year or something like that. C86 kind of became synonymous with that jingly jangly indie sound that sort of it has been so versatile for the next 30 years. It's so revered because indie was sort of co-opted by major labels in the 90s, and it caused indie music to have to go back underground in order to retain its identity. It causes some people to see it as a golden age, basically. The CD market had led to sort of heritage rock repackaging music in magazines like Q. And so you have a kind of built-in obsolescence with these songs that the music industry just doesn't respond to now anymore. You wouldn't get so many bands being signed up for just one song and then being binned in the way that quite a lot of the bands on C86
were.
It's
incredible. I can't
explain why exactly its charm is so sort of revered in indie circles, but it's got something to do with how indie music behaved after that.
Well, I think I'm fairly clued up on music, but looking at the back of this album, I recognise one song out of about, what is it, 60, 70?
Well, basically,
it's crazy.
This is
really intimidating.
Yeah, basically, it's a repackaged situation with three discs. The first disc is the track listing of the original release, but disc two and disc three, they got the original compiler, a writer called Neil Taylor, to come in and sort of assemble all the songs that they were thinking about putting on and sort of songs from associated acts from that era. So what you have is an awful lot of bands that you've basically never heard of, but they're all playing a kind of music that is now recognisable because they were kind of ahead of their time a little bit.
Yeah, so we've got Bogshed,
yeah,
Half Man, Half Biscuit.
Half Man, Half Biscuit is still going.
Wow. We've got a Fuzzbox and we're going to use it.
Yeah.
Petrol Emotion.
They were an Undertones spin-off. Mm. Yeah.
Stitched Back Foot Airman.
Yeah, I can't really defend that one.
Yeah,
it's
terrible.
Yeah, no. Happy Mondays are on it. Pot Will Eat Itself as
so
well.
So is Primal Scream.
Velocity Girl, Primal Scream, the first song on the album, that summarises perfectly the C86 sound.
Jesus
music,
and Mary Chain.
The music stripped back out of... take all the unnecessary elements out of it, and it's a minute and 22 seconds long. Very short, very sweet, and from an incarnation of Primal Scream that you've probably never heard before. It costs less than £20. Go and buy it from an independent record shop, do the whole indie thing and the whole spirit of it. It's an absolutely fantastic release. I'm going to review it a bit more in depth on the website in the coming days, but it's, don't know what to say, I'll just leave it there.
Well, let's wind down for the week. In a week or two, we'll return with episode 14, hosted by both of us. As usual, we'll be talking about significant music news and new tracks. We'll be reviewing new albums and some classic albums. We'll be talking new records by Manic Street Preachers, George Ezra, La Rue, and 5 Seconds of Summer. Seriously?
Yeah, yeah.
In addition, there are also albums coming out by Eno/Hyde, their second this year already.
I know.
Robin Thicke, Owl City, and Sia. If we're not talking about them next time, they will definitely be reviewed on our website, which you must type into the address bar of your browser. In the album anniversary section, we'll look back at the Beatles' 1964 record, A Hard Day's Night, which is turning 50.
Incredible.
And at Elliot Smith's 1994 debut record, Roman Candle. As usual, if you enjoy slightly pretentious analysis mixed with unnecessary rants, and you've liked what you've heard here, you can join in the conversation. Twitter... at LG Melodies, finding us on Facebook at Laser Guided Melodies, or find us on Tumblr by searching for the same thing. As a closing note, we'll do the albums of the fortnight. What have you chosen this week?
Well, I think number one has to be Antlers.
Lana
second, definitely, and third, I mean, there's been a three-way tie here. I mean, Tom Veck, I thought about. I mean, Tom Veck's now not quite the power that he used to be, largely because he spent 6 years making a follow-up to his debut.
Wow.
There's also a record by a guy called Alex G, who's made his first full-length release after a series of internet-only releases. That's also pretty good. But I'm going to plump for Happiness, actually. So I went to see them at...
Happiness with a Y.
They got an album called Weird Little Birthday. It's kind of a concept album about a boy who shares his birthday with Jesus and becomes driven insane by jealousy as a result. Not the kind of concept that you think would hold well together, but it's very lo-fi and cute and charming. I saw them at the Brudenell Social Club on Saturday. They were very good. So that's third. So Antlers, Lana Del Rey, and Happiness. Go bye.
Until next time, goodbye.